Side Opinion Radio, we discuss the Ultimate Fight Night, more updates on the IFL, and an interview with Brad Imes. All that and more on this week's edition of Side Opinion Radio on SideOpinion.com.
And welcome once again to another edition of Fight Opinion Radio. I am your host, Rob Sayers, being joined by Aaron Bucknell. How's it going tonight, Aaron?
It's going pretty good tonight. I'm in a bit of a silly mood, but hopefully I won't offend anyone with too much of my inanity tonight.
Oh, I wouldn't count on that. judging from, is that a new stalker that's on our forum now, or is that the same guy from your forum? Somewhere in nasty comments.
I don't know. I can't tell who's who. None of them are willing to leave their real name, so I'm just going to assume it's all the same person.
Well, you know, it's good to have a large fan base. Maybe it'd be good to assume it's more than one. I don't know.
Okay, we'll just go with it's more than one. I have a multitude of stalkers.
Awesome. And as always, we have an amazing show lined up for you guys. See the Ultimate Fight Night. We're going to be previewing that and making our expert predictions. An interview with the Ultimate Fighter Season 2 finalist, Brad Imes, talking about his upcoming fight with Dan Christensen, among other things. More big news from the IFL, and we're going to be both reporting and maybe criticizing a little bit about some recent decisions made by the UFC and Dream Stage Entertainment. Before we get into all that, though, I want to give out the contact information so you folks playing along at home can get in touch with us. You can always email me at rsayers@gmail.com. My lovely co-host Aaron can be emailed at
ERIU@hotmail.com and send me emails. I don't get nearly enough.
I get too many, but you can still send me email. That's fine too. I like to know people are listening. And of course, our amazingly awesome website at www.fightopinion.com. And if you haven't checked it out yet, we still like you to drop by and say hello in our forums at fightopinion.com/forum, or just go to the website and click the big forum button in the upper right hand corner. This past weekend, Aaron, you had a chance to witness some live MMA, the IFC show at the Arco Arena in Sacramento. Apparently it was not all you had hoped it would be. How did that go?
You can't really say it wasn't all that I had hoped it to be, because even from the very beginning, I was pretty leery about this. I mean, I originally heard about it through a Ticketmaster announcement like 2 months ago saying it was coming. There was nothing about it anywhere on the group's official website, anywhere online, and they didn't do any promotion until about 2 weeks before the show even was, you know, set to go on. So I really wasn't expecting a whole lot to begin with. Then the day before the show, the California State Athletic Commission got all involved, and about half the matches got axed or rearranged. And then when I actually got there, there's a big sign on the door saying Bobby Southworth will not be fighting, which was which, you know, really isn't too surprising either. So all in all, I didn't really expect much of anything from them, and I pretty much got it.
Now, once everything did get underway and, you know, the fights began and, you know, the event was really going, you know, how was it? What was the quality of the fights? What would you say the fight of the night was? You know, all that good stuff.
The fights were fine. I have no problem with anyone who was fighting on it. They all did rather well. There was a few quick fights, but, you know, that's only to be expected on smaller shows. Probably the fight of the night was the main event, which was James Irvin versus Bill Hill. Poor Irvin got a groin shot really early in the first round, so there was a few minutes where he had to recover from that. And then after that, it was a really well-fought match by both of them, with Irvin coming out with the decision at the end. Unfortunately, there was only 6 matches that ended up being on the card, and the show started about an hour late, and we got a whole lot of let's spend some time with the ring girls, which I really have no interest in.
It's really disappointing how organizations would fumble something like this. With California obviously being such a hotbed market, and it is obviously a place where the sport is going to explode, you would think that, you know, they'd really be crossing their T's and dotting their I's when running an event like this to make sure things go smooth, especially in the beginning.
Had the IFC had everything in order and ready to go, and not given the State Athletic Commission anything to pick on them about, then everything would have gone smoothly. But the fact that some people didn't have medical clearance and some people weren't the right weight and all this other stuff allowed the Athletic Commission to throw their weight around and get a lot of stuff changed.
So it was the IFC themselves who really sort of fumbled this?
I think it was kind of a combination of both. I think because it was the first show in Sacramento where all the government is, they, you know, this was the one show that they really wanted to get all involved in. But the IFC should have known they were going to do that. They should have been prepared and ready and had everything ready to go, held all their ducks in a row and all that kind of stuff, and they really didn't. I would also like to point out, I want to know whoever was in charge of giving out comp tickets really needs to pay more attention to the politics that's going on, because whoever it was that came up with the idea of seating Joe Riggs and Nick Diaz about 30 feet apart from each other really wasn't thinking on this one.
How did that turn out?
Unfortunately, they were both really professional. As far as I know, they never even made eye contact with each other. But the fact that no one considered that this could be a bad situation really wasn't good planning. And I've got to, you know, give props to both guys for reacting really professionally in what I'm sure was an incredibly uncomfortable situation for both of them.
No, absolutely. I mean, these are two guys who not only fought, you know, very recently in the UFC, but then fought immediately after in the hospital.
I don't think it would go over very well for the IFC to be known as the first group to have a show in Sacramento, and then to have two guys who aren't even fighting on the card, but our professional fighters starting a brawl in the aisle probably wouldn't go over too well.
One has to wonder, maybe that was an intentional move on their part to try to get a little controversy stirred up.
If it was, that is the most immature, ridiculous thing I have ever heard. That is not the kind of attention you want. And quite frankly, once again, I just really want to point out that both of them, as far as I can tell, were completely professional. And I think it was really good of them for them to have not done anything where it's obvious that they really could have.
Absolutely. And my hat's off to both fighters. I don't know if I could have remained that calm in a situation like that.
And speaking of people going to fights, I heard that you were involved in a little something this weekend, weren't you?
Yeah. Do I have to talk about this?
Oh, come on. Yes, you do. You're going to be a fighter. You got to tell us all about it.
Okay. Well, let's just say my amateur grappling record has continued to nosedive. I think I'm about 1-5 now or something like that. I went to a very well-run tournament. I must commend these people. First of all, it was run by a local school in the Little Rock area called Living Defense Martial Arts. These guys put on a spectacular tournament, the first martial arts tournament I have ever seen in my life that started on time.
That's awesome.
I didn't know
it's a good thing.
Even way back when I did traditional martial arts and I would show up to do, you know, kata forms and all that good crap, you know, the little local tournaments would always start at least an hour or two late. So I was really, really impressed they were able to handle, you know, weight classes and all this other stuff and still get everything started on time. So, you know, I get there. It was about a 4-hour drive. I left Jackson, Mississippi, around 5-something in the morning, you know, no big deal. It was just a quick drive up there.
Did you have to make use of your Pedialyte this time?
No, the weight class I was in, had a ceiling of 190, but because the turnout was low, they kind of did the weight classes as small, medium, and big people. so I believe I was thrown in medium people, because I did notice there were guys, they did another bracket of guys who looked a lot smaller than me, another bracket of guys who looked a lot bigger than me. So I imagine I was in the medium bracket, even though my weight, I was technically sort of light heavyweight. I looked small for my weight, though. So I guess, I guess my looks were deceiving and that helped. But I, you know, I got there, I was doing men's, beginner no gi. Their beginner division was anybody with less than 2 years experience. So I felt comfortable where I was competing, as far as the experience and everything. You know, I felt good going into it. My wind was good. My technique has felt better than it ever has. The first match, this guy absolutely dominates me. He gets the takedown, lands in side control. I can't escape his side control for the life of me. So I give him the mount. Foolishly, I'm sure, according to some people, but my mount escapes are better than my side control escapes. So, and as I hoped, I was able to escape his mount. I rolled him over, and as soon as his back hit the mat, he went for an armbar. I stacked him, got out of the armbar, and immediately found myself caught in a triangle. I tried waiting it out, but things started going a little fuzzy on me, so I decided to tap out on that one.
Yeah, when things go fuzzy, tapping out's a good idea at this point.
As I've learned harshly before. So this guy who beat me, I forget his name, he ends up winning the whole division, you know, so you lose to the guy.
That's good.
Yeah.
If you're gonna lose, it might as well be to the guy who won everything.
Absolutely. And I mean, as far as I know, I could have been second best. I wasn't, but, you know, you always have that in the back of your mind. So, I go again to determine third or fourth place, and immediately I feel like I'm better than this guy. I feel really good against him. I'm working some good guard stuff. I'm trying to break his posture down so I can work some rubber guard. He's real stiff, using a lot of strength, so I feel like he's going to make a mistake at any point. As I keep trying to break his posture, he keeps leaning back further and further. So finally I manage to do a sit-up sweep and sweep him right off the mat. So we have to restart in the middle with him in my guard again. I actually didn't get awarded the sweep. So,
yeah.
Not long after that, he does manage to pass my guard, rolls me over, takes my back. No body control. I'm feeling completely okay about this. He's trying to sink in a choke. And while he's doing this, I'm just triangling one of his legs so I can go for a knee bar, when I get the opportunity. And he's still working for a choke. You know, I casually reach up to remove his arm from my neck, and the safety conscious referee thinks I tap out. And stops the match. So,
are you kidding me?
No. You know, and that's fine. It was an amateur tournament. Yeah, I'd rather have him stop it early than late. And the guy came up to me later. He's like, man, I'm really sorry. He felt really bad about what had happened. And, you know, I understood why he did it. And, you know, had I raised a fuss about it, I may have gotten him to, you know, start the match over, but I don't like to be the guy who whines and makes a big deal out of everything, especially at a small amateur tournament like this.
Right.
So, you know, I feel good about it. Both matches, went pretty well. The first match, even though the guy was, you know, even though I lost, I did some good stuff. Some of my escapes and reversals were good. Second match, I felt really good about until the ghost tap. So, I don't know. I think it went pretty well overall. Next tournament's coming up here locally. It's a small, very small gi tournament, and I pretty much do that every year just because it's local. But hopefully I do better than I did at this the last few I've been to. My record's not looking so good right now.
But it's not like you've had a huge amount of fights and they've all been horrible, and everyone has bad days.
Yeah, I need to start having some good ones.
There you go.
But we're going to go ahead and head to a commercial break, and when we get back, we're going to talk about real professional fighters, the people I'm sure you actually tuned in to hear about. Not your, really sucky host here.
For my, you know, adventures at watching other people fight.
Absolutely. So we're going to go ahead and head to a break. When we get back, we're going to be joined with Zach Arnold, and we're going to talk about the Ultimate Fight Night show and, who we think is going to be the big winners and losers on that card. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
Looking to buy a ring for your wrestling, boxing, or MMA promotion?
Unleash a monster!
Are you looking for a cage, steel security rails, vinyl canvas and mat covers, a ring belt, or a ring trailer?
Unleash a monster.
Are you looking for a 6 or 8-sided ring? Do you want your own custom design?
Unleash a monster.
Monster Wrestling and Boxing Rings is your complete source for all kinds of rings and accessories. If your business is wrestling, boxing, or MMA, if you need a complete ring, a custom design, or even a do-it-yourself kit, then
Unleash a monster.
Monster rings are used by large promotions, independent promotions, training centers, movie studios, television companies, video game companies, churches, government agencies, nightclubs, bars, youth leagues, martial arts studios, and individuals around the world. Monster Rings sells more rings than all their competitors combined. So,
unleash a monster.
Head to MonsterWrestlingRings.com and explore all the options. Forget the rest. Buy from the best. MonsterWrestlingRings.com.
Unleash a monster.
Today.
Okay, move the band here. Yeah, that's very nice. It's very nice. Okay, all right. Hurry up. Okay, put that over there. Oh, no. Oh, jeez. No, careful with that. All right, ready? Set that up. Action. What can you find at Cockatoo.com?
Fresh opinions.
Very informative segments.
Plus, tons of original content.
Plus, our store of Japanese fight goods and Cockatoo Fan Radio. So check us out at www.kakuto.com.
HeroDVDSource.com. Best of 2005, Volume 2 is the bomb. $12 double DVD, best deal this side of Guam. With Dr. Keith doing commentary, you can't go wrong. Listen to it all day long. No megaphones were harmed in the making of this DVD.
Yes, ParesuDVDSource.com presents the Best of 2005, Volume 2, featuring Dr. Keith Pitsky, Adam Summers, and even some guy named Dave Prezak. Check it out at ParesuDVDSource.com. ParesuDVDSource.com.
Once again, you are back listening to Fight Opinion Radio. I'm Rob Sayers, joined by Aaron Bucknell and Zach Arnold. On this segment, we're going to be going over with a fine-tooth comb and giving our expert analysis on the Ultimate Fight Night card coming up here on the 6th. Some interesting matchups, some that appear to be beatdowns, and the Ultimate Fight Night cards have always been really good, the couple they've had so far, so definitely looking forward to this. Aaron, before we get started going fight by fight, just your take on the overall card. What do you think? Do you think this is going to be as successful as the previous shows, or maybe you think they're running out of steam, or what's your take on this?
Overall, I think it's going to be an okay. I mean, for free TV, hey, it's great there's free fights. I'm not going to argue with that, but compared to the lineups coming up on the pay-per-views, it's kind of okay. Although I would say it's also about probably on par with at least the last Ultimate Fight Night, which I wasn't really hugely excited about that one either.
I don't know. I thought the last one was really good. I really enjoyed that. I don't know. I guess because I don't expect much, it's free TV. I'm always really surprised when the fights end up being really good. I think I was drinking during the last one too. Maybe that's why it was so good. I don't know.
There you go.
Getting into the fights, I want to start out, we're not going to cover the whole card because there's quite a few, bouts here, but let's start off with, and I'm going to go ahead and pick it right now. Fight of the night, Luke Kumo versus Jason Von Flue. You have two guys who were on season 2, both fought at 170 on the show. Somewhat similar styles. You have guys who are really good strikers, but really kind of ready to bring a brawl, bring a real war to the match. Who's your pick for this fight, Aaron?
I really don't know. I'm going to have to go with Von Flue just because he has such an odd fighting style that it might be kind of hard for Luke to work around that. But in general, I think it's just going to be a great fight. It's going to be really unorthodox and just a really entertaining fight to watch.
I agree. You have two guys who are fairly unorthodox. Certainly in Luke Kumo, this guy can be just straight weird at times. One thing I can almost guarantee, this is going to be a stand-up war. These guys are both excellent strikers, and you know, I would say the smart bet is Jason Von Flue, but I'm going to pick Luke Kumo by upset. I think that he's going to just pull something out, and I think striking, this guy is going to be hard to beat, and I think we're going to see him as a having a bright future in UFC's welterweight division due to his striking.
Well, and not only is it going to be a stand-up, but it's going to be a fast-paced stand-up, because from what I've seen from both these guys, neither one of them's the let's stand in circle and faint a couple of punches for 5 minutes at each other. They're probably just going to charge each other and start swinging as hard as they can and just go from there.
I agree. These are three guys who really like to engage and, you know, they fight hard and are willing to go till the very end. So, we saw them put on some amazing fights during The Ultimate Fighter, and, I think we're going to see nothing but fireworks. And, we're either going to see a lot of fireworks or a really early knockout. Speaking of knockout, Chris Lieben has really made a name for himself outside of being a season one standout by knocking out nearly everyone he's faced since he's been on the UFC roster. And he faces sort of an unknown fighter in Luigi Fioravante, I believe is how you pronounce his last name. Luigi brings in a perfect 7-0 record. But, you know, he's really sort of an unknown. Do you know much about this guy, Zach?
We know he trains at American Top Team, so he's probably got some good trainers, definitely some Brazilian jiu-jitsu crossover. So if he can get it on the ground, it would be an interesting fight, certainly for Lieben. He has the best of both worlds. He came from Team Quest in Gresham, Oregon, and now he's training in for AMC Pancration in Seattle. So I got to think Lieben will get the win here. The question is how is he going to do it? I don't think he wants it on the ground. I certainly think he wants to get a knockout here, although there certainly is a slight chance of a decision on this fight.
You know, not knowing enough about Fioravante, never seeing him fight, it's really hard for me to say how the fight's going to go. I think that Lieben, despite being known for his knockout power, he's a very well-rounded guy, as you mentioned, trained with two of the best camps in mixed martial arts. He submitted Edwin Deweese, who everybody said, you know, as long if, you know, Deweese can get him down, he'll submit Lieben. You know, Lieben's just a brawler. You know, Lieben submitted a decorated submission guy in Deweese. He knocked out Rivera recently, who's known as a really great striker. I think he's on a roll, and he's got the tools to really beat anybody in this division. And I don't really see an upset here.
I'm just going to go with Lieben strictly because, A, we don't know much about Luigi, and secondly, I don't think UFC would put Lieben with someone that they'd really be afraid of him losing to, because they're really pushing him right now, and for all of that, I'm going with Lieben. I think he's going to knock him out.
Now, the next fight is Joe Stevenson versus Josh Neer. Stevenson, of course, the Ultimate Fighter champion at 170 pounds from Season 2. He's facing an experienced fighter in Josh Neer. This is another fight. Neer is definitely a good guy, but I think Stevenson brings too much to the table. I don't think that Neer will have enough answers for the questions that Stevenson is going to bring to this fight.
Well, basically, I'm going with you on that. I think Stevenson, I don't see Stevenson losing anytime soon to pretty much anybody, with the exception of the top-tier guys, and I don't think this fight's going to be any different. I'm going with Stevenson.
You know, Stevenson has plowed through people he has faced so far. Luke brought him a really good fight, but everyone else, he's really dispatched fairly quick. You really got to wonder where he's heading. Welterweight being one of the most stacked divisions in the UFC, you, of course, have an extremely dominant champion in Matt Hughes. You have George St. Pierre, Carl Parisian. You have so many good people. You know, will a win here against Josh Neer give him some steam to kind of get into the rankings, get fights with some of the guys who are, you know, just slightly below, you know, your Hughes's and your St. Pierre's?
All I'm caring about right now, I just want to see him versus Sanchez at some point, because he's one of the few people that I think really has a good chance of just beating the crap out of Sanchez, and I would love to see that.
Now, that would be a good fight. That would be one hell of a fight. And next up is guy who was, I guess, supposed to be one of the new heavyweight stars in the UFC's sort of lacking division there, but I guess pulled a fool us all when he announced he was dropping to light heavyweight, Rashad Evans versus arguably the most hated man from Ultimate Fighter Season 1, Sam Hoger. Your thoughts on this, Aaron?
I really dislike Sam. I'm going along with everyone else, and, you know, the programming of Sam being the evil villain for the last half of Ultimate Fighter Season 1, but quite frankly, I don't think Rashad's got enough to beat him. I'm going to go with Sam on this one.
I think of the fights we're discussing, this is probably going to end up being the closest. You have two guys who to look at them and to see them fight never really look spectacular. Nothing really stands out. They're both kind of notorious for taking fights to decisions, but they all kind of have the tools to get the job done. And, you know, when they get in the ring, they win fights. They're not necessarily the strongest finishers, and they do tend to have fairly orthodox but somewhat plain styles. Honestly, I think it's a toss-up. I think Hoger's probably got a better chance of winning, but either way, this one's going to the judges.
I'll say this about Hoger and Rashad Evans. If there's any indication that these guys have the same characteristics from their last fights, Hoger's going to have better conditioning than Evans. Evans gassed out against Brad Hines, and he had a chance to finish him, and he didn't do it. You would think that he would be able to gain some momentum, at least in training and learning how to finish a fight, but we don't know that. That's really the X factor in this fight. If Evans can't finish it, you know, Hoger's got a real shot of winning this.
You know, I remember the knockdown in the Rashad Himes fight. I know everybody thought that was over when it happened, and it just, you know, when you score such a devastating blow against your opponent and you're, you know, too tired to finish up on that or to follow up with that, that really speaks a lot about your conditioning, even more so than when you're in trouble. You know, not being able to capitalize on dominance is really bad. And, you know, Hoger is, he's a Miletic fighter, has good conditioning. I think he's just going to bring more tools to the table. The main event of the fight is going to be Stefan Bonner versus Keith Jardine, two more Ultimate Fighter alumni. This fight takes place in light heavyweight, with Keith Jardine stepping down from heavyweight to the light heavyweight division. We have Stefan Bonner, the runner-up from Season 1. He's a Carlson Gracie student, Golden Gloves boxer, great submissions, a very well-rounded guy, as we've seen in all his fights. And we have Keith Jardine, who is a heavyweight on the Ultimate Fighter Season 2. He advanced pretty well on that show until he was defeated by Rashad Evans. He defeated Kerry Shaw on the Ultimate Fighter 2 finale by TKO. UFC 57, he defeated Mike Whitehead. And that was a fight, I believe, that took place at 205, the same division he's in now. So you have a guy who seems to be going pretty well. Things are going well for him in the fight game. Not too dissimilar from Stefan Bonner. Obviously, I think a lot of what's going on with Bonner right now, he's still riding a wave of success after the show. And, you know, this will be the first fight that's taken place since the death of his instructor. So, you know, while that did happen a while ago, you kind of wonder how that's going to affect him, this being the first time in the octagon since that happened. I'm going with Bonner based more on just kind of gut instinct more than anything. I think this is going to come down to who's either conditioned better or, you know, just who wants it more. You know, otherwise, this is going to be a really good competitive fight. Aaron?
I like Stefan Bonner a lot. He's done really well since the Ultimate Fighter season finale. He's had some really good fights, and I really haven't seen anything that's hugely impressed me about Keith Jardine. He's won a few fights, but nothing hugely impressive against anyone, you know, of any tremendous skill. So I'm going to go with Stefan Bonner on this one simply because I think he's a much better fighter.
I favor Bonner, but I wouldn't be surprised if Jardine was able to pull something out.
I would think Bonner is the favorite going into this fight. The only question is conditioning. You know, we saw in the Forrest Griffin fight, he certainly went all the way, but he was gassed out. We'll see what he can do, because he finished off James Irvin by submission, and he had a nasty submission on him, that guy. Probably the same result here.
That was one of the nastiest kimuras I have ever seen. My shoulder hurt watching that.
It's interesting to see what happens in regards to his training, because no instructor, so, you know, things are different. I think the routine's a little bit different. We'll see what happens.
And that definitely has the potential to impact Stefan Bonner's game. So we'll play a little wait and see there. But I still think Bonner's going to be the favorite going into this, and he's my pick to win that fight. Oh, you mentioned talking about what fights are going to be aired and which are not. There's a lot of fights on this card, and obviously to fit in the time slot that they have, they're only going to be able to air about four or five fights, realistically only four. And, you know, from what we're seeing, obviously the main event is Stephen Bonner versus Keith Jardine. No question we're going to see that. Rashad Evans versus Sam Hoger. You have Rashad, his first fight after winning the whole thing in heavyweight at the last show. Stevenson, similar situation in his fight. Chris Lieben is probably the biggest star to come off of that reality show. Now, if there's going to be four fights aired, you know, you can pretty much bet that those are going to be the ones that air. But, you know, that's leaving off, you know, Kumo versus Von Flu, which has the potential to be really good. I think Berkman versus Fitch is going to end up being really good. I think it's sort of a shame that we're going to see a lot of fights not air that really are going to have the potential to be even better than, you know, potentially the main event. And speaking of John Fitch, I want to mention, I had a chance to talk to him on the phone yesterday. And first off, really cool guy. He was really awesome to talk to. And I'd like to thank him again for giving us some time to the chat. He's coming in as a bit of an unknown on this card, but his background, he actually has a good bit of experience. He's fought on a lot of, I guess as he puts it, on a lot of cards that were sort of here today, gone tomorrow, promotions that started up. He was on, you know, some of their early cards, often their first card, and then they were MIA, sometimes leaving him without paychecks. So this guy's not had the best luck as far as finding a good steady promotion. He's in the UFC now. He's coming off a win from which I believe was the last Ultimate Fight Night. And, interestingly enough, and I want to segue into this for a little while, just because it's sort of interesting. Most people don't know about this. He's actually had several fights down in, Mexico. You know, when you hear about the scene in, you know, Japan, Brazil, Canada, the U.S., Mexico is one of those countries you really don't hear much about. According to John, the crowds down there are, extremely into the sport. The fans love it. The live crowds are amazing. The promoters, pretty much treat you like you're, you know, a superhero down there. They accommodate you in any way they can, except for the money situation. Apparently the money in Mexico is even worse than it is in the smaller U.S. shows. And while they really, really like mixed martial arts down there, the money situation is really bad. John had mentioned he had some fights in Juarez, Mexico, and I believe he even said one of those he never got a paycheck for, while it was actually a pro fight. But he had some fights in Monterrey, and he said that being that there was a kind of a bigger area, a lot more money in that region, the situation was a lot better. But overall, while the fans love it, not nearly as appreciative of the ground game as, say, the Japanese fans. They really like the sport, and, you know, I'd really like to see, you know, I'd like to see mixed martial arts everywhere, but I think with the fan base down there kind of already accepting the sport, you know, I think we may see some big market opportunities open up south of the border.
You know, and the big question is can you rely on Mexican promoters because of the gang situation down there? It's similar to pro wrestling down there. You're not sure who your friend is from your, you know, from your foe.
Actually, I'm not entirely familiar with that situation. You want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, one of the reasons why a lot of foreign workers, at least Americans, like to work in Tijuana, or they like to work, you know, near the borders, and it's not exactly a great place to be if you're a foreigner. That's why Monterrey, which is 8 hours south of Texas, and other areas which are near the border are much more desirable to work than working down in south in the country.
I've never been to Mexico, so I wasn't really aware that you know, the whole gang and crime situation really came into play for something like wrestling or mixed martial arts. I know a little bit about their wrestling culture. I realize that's a really big deal down there. So, and perhaps that's why they're a little more accepting to MMA than, you know, maybe some other markets are.
Tijuana is going to be interesting because there was a show there recently, a couple weeks ago, and the wrestling market there is burned. So they have a new renovated auditorium there, seats about 7,000, and it's a really good potential spot for them to run MMA.
Getting on track from our little digression into what Mr. Fitch had to offer, after the the Ultimate Fight Night, the next big thing, I believe it starts this Thursday, if I'm not mistaken, is the Ultimate Fighter Season 3. What are your kind of expectations going into this, Aaron? We have, you know, Tito versus Ken as the coaches, and it's a different situation where, you know, Season 1, you had two guys who were competitors, but, you know, really good sportsmen about it with Chuck and Randy. Season 2, there were guys who weren't even in the same weight class. But here you have two guys who are, you know, basically scheduled to fight each other in the future and classically have hated each other. What do you think? Is that going to detract from maybe the real personalities as far as the fighters? Or is it going to be focused more on that drama? Or what do you think we can expect from this season?
Well, I certainly hope that, you know, we have a bit better fights than last year and we have interesting challenges and interesting fighter personalities. The real truth is, everyone just wants to see Ken and Tito just go after each other. Everyone knows they don't like each other. They've gotten in fights before. They yell at each other. Everyone's picked a side, pretty much. I think that the Tito and Ken drama is going to be what everyone tunes in for. And I'm certainly hoping that the fighters themselves will actually be enough to keep everyone interested and be able to, you know, balance out the Tito and Ken show.
It's interesting one way or the other. You have a show that was originally focused on, you know, the personalities of the fighters, and here we're kind of bringing in a whole new aspect. Do you think maybe this is just something they're trying new, or maybe in response to the fact that maybe the fighters on Season 2 weren't quite as colorful as the Season 1 fighters?
I think it might be a combination of both. There might be the fact that, you know, that the fighters in Season 2 weren't as great personality-wise as in the first season. But, of course, a big thing about the first season was that there was, you know, lots of free-flowing alcohol contributed quite well to, you know, what happened in Season 1. And rightly so, they got rid of it in Season 2. But I think a good chunk of why they brought in Tito and Ken is to boost the ratings and, you know, basically have a good fight to build up for afterwards, because you had the Randy and Chuck fight after Season 1, and then you knew that Franklin and Hughes weren't going to fight after Season 2, so you really didn't have that kind of whole build-up to it.
It's definitely good build-up for that main event when they do fight. You know, I just worry it's going to detract from the show that's really supposed to be focused on, you know, the fighters and the up-and-coming guys who've been fighting in the smaller pro shows, trying to make it in the big league, so to speak, and you know, I just hope that this whole, because honestly, the whole Ken versus Tito thing doesn't interest me in the least. I don't know. Maybe it's just me. I grew up not being really a pro wrestling fan. I got into MMA because it wasn't pro wrestling. So maybe, I'm just sort of naturally predisposed to not really enjoy the drama of it all. But I don't know. I think it may, detract from what the show really should be focusing on.
Oh, it's definitely us, you know, former and current pro wrestling fans who are definitely all about the drama between Tito and Ken. And the fact that, you know, at least in part, it's real hatred between the two of them. I have no doubt that they, you know, pick it up a little bit just because they can. But I'm definitely attracted to the drama of this season. And I'm hoping that the fights will be good enough to, you know, balance it all out as well.
And an interesting thing, not a lot is known about, you know, the fighters. All of them are, I think, kind of on equal footing as far as their previous exposure to the market. I did want to point out, and I forgot the guy's name. I remember looking on the website. He's originally from the country of Jordan, but one of the fighters on the show actually went to high school in Olive Branch, Mississippi. So I'm just going to go ahead and cheer for that guy right now. You know, basically a hometown fighter. So good luck to him. And
I've also heard that one of the fighters is technically deaf. Very interesting fight condition.
I have heard that as well, and that will be interesting to see, you know, how that all works out, how they're able to coach and, you know, whatnot.
Well, I hope Mario Yamazaki's not the referee.
Oh, man. That is no lie. Somebody will die. And that's going to do it for our look at the Ultimate Fight Night and the Ultimate Fighter season coming up here. When we get back from the commercial break, we're going to sit down with Ultimate Fighter Season 2 alumni and finalist Brad Imes. He's going to talk to us about his fight coming up on the Ultimate Fight Night, the fallout from his being on the Ultimate Fighter show, his reaction to the original opponent being replaced, and a couple more tidbits of information, and we'll be getting to that next as soon as we get back.
IVPvideos.com, $2.99 per DVD, over 700 DVDs in stock. Old school, new school, you name it, they have it, IVPvideos.com. DVDs with the custom covers that cannot be purchased anywhere else. 3-day guaranteed shipping, just 3 days. Order it 3 days later, you more than likely will have it and enjoy all the finest that is IVPvideos.com. Yes, IVPvideos.com.
Think you've seen real fight action? Don't miss the debut of the International Fight League, Saturday, April 29th at the Trump Taj Mahal in Atlantic City, New Jersey. 4 teams, coached by legends Pat Militich, Boss Rutten, Enzo Gracie, and Maurice Smith, present some of the toughest fighters on the planet in pure fight action as they go to battle in the world's first mixed martial arts league. Get your tickets now and be there for the next level of mixed martial arts combat. The International Fight League, Saturday, April 29th at the Trump Taj Mahal in Atlantic City. Tickets on sale now at Ticketmaster.com or by calling 1-800-736-1420. The International Fight League, pure sport. For more information, go to IFL.TV.
The Mississippi Academy of Grappling, located in Clinton, Mississippi, teaches a variety of martial arts and a program designed to give you the valuable skills needed for sport or self-defense, as well as provide an excellent way to stay in shape. Instructor Randall Powell has 17 years' experience in the martial arts. He holds 3 black belts, 1 in judo and the other 2 in different styles of Japanese jiu-jitsu. Currently, he holds a blue belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which he earned in 2002 under the instruction of Pedro Sauer. A weekly class schedule teaches mixed martial arts training on Tuesday nights, along with judo and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu on Thursday nights. To find out more about the Mississippi Academy of Grappling, check us out on the web at www.msgrappling.com or call us by phone at 601-966-8358. I'm your host, Rob Sayers, along with Zach Arnold. And joining us today, we have a special guest. We have Ultimate Fighter Season 2 finalist, Brad Imes. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing good.
Are you, like, specifically in, game mode right now? Or are you taking a little time to enjoy the city? Or how's that going?
Oh, I just, I'm here on business, so I haven't really been doing any sightseeing. I've probably seen enough of Vegas. I've been here like a dozen times, I think, since I was on the show.
Gotcha.
Pretty much now it's just, I got this morning, went and worked out. I've been making sure I eat every 3 hours and resting during the day, and then I got a training in the night, so.
Now, a lot of people, of course, know you from the Ultimate Fighter show, but for those who aren't immediately familiar with where you're from, can you give us a little bit of background on how you got into MMA, where you're training now, and just sort of how you got to where you are now in the sport?
In my athletic background, I played football at the University of Missouri, and then I played arena football with the Iowa Barnstormers, and played semi-pro in Texas, and then played for an indoor team in St. Louis, and then I took a job in Sacramento, California in 2003, running a large retail company. And in May 2004, I got laid off of work and I was waiting tables and doing construction and stuff. And a friend of mine suggested that I try fighting. He had fought in Japan. He was a big guy. I was also a football player, didn't have a whole lot of fight experience, but you know, had made a great deal of money fighting just because of the size and everything. He's like, you know, you should give it a shot. You're a big guy. You know, you probably make good money. I was like, all right, why not? So August of 2004, I started training. And then, had a fight, had an amateur fight a month later, which I actually got knocked out in the first round in. And then 3 weeks after that, I had my first professional fight and won. And then I had two more pro fights, won both of those. And then, and I got on the Ultimate Fighter reality show and did very well in that. And, now this is my first fight since November, since I fought in the finale.
Now, when you first started, when you first made the switch to mixed martial arts and decided you wanted to try that, where were you training?
I was training in Sacramento, California with, a Brazilian jiu-jitsu class. It's called Sacramento Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. It was run by Carlos Garcia. And, it was a good start for me. Carlos had some, connections with a fight promotion in Lemoore, California called World Extreme Cage Fighting. And, he got me my first pro fight with him. And, he pretty much trained me in boxing and wrestling and jiu-jitsu all from the get-go. And, you know, before I, got on the show and then after the show, I moved from California to Iowa. And I've been training with Miletich pretty exclusively since December.
The Miletich camp, of course, needs no introduction. They're one of the biggest camps, especially in the UFC. How has training with them been different, and how has that really shaped your game?
It's been an amazing opportunity for me. We have really a great heavyweight camp up there. I mean, we have myself. Ben Rothwell, who will be fighting in the IFL coming up this month, and Tim Sylvie, of course. And then we also have Sam Hogar trains there, who he's a 205, but you know, he's a big guy as well. And then we also have a number of other, you know, guys that fight in smaller shows or amateurs that are also, you know, good training partners. So, and plus, you know, Pat Miletich is there, who's an incredible coach. We have other great boxing coaches, jiu-jitsu coaches, and then just, you know, fighters from all over the country that come in there, you know, all the time just to train and learn from Pat and the other guys that are there. So it's been great for me. It's really helped me to advance my game even faster than I had before.
You go into this fight in UFC facing an opponent that you weren't originally scheduled to face. How does the change in booking of that opponent in change your strategy in terms of training?
Well, I didn't find out that Gabriel wasn't going to be able to fight until, about a week and a half ago, probably. And by that time I had pretty much done all the training that I was going to do. I only had about a week left before I came to Vegas. So, you know, it went from, I was training to fight a guy that was a jiu-jitsu specialist. And my sole goal with fighting him was to keep on our feet, to, you know, defend takedowns and to just wear him out on our feet. You know, and now I changed to a guy who's, you know, a very good striker, and Dan, who's also my height, and who also is a decent ground fighter. So, they're really almost polar opposites of the kind of guys I'm fighting, but the good thing is that I train with, you know, Tim Sylvie and Ben Rothwell, both, you know, Ben 6'6 and Tim 6'8. So, you know, I have the perfect sparring partners to match Dan's style. And I think that, you know, I'm more than prepared for this fight just because of who I've been training with. So, you know, I think it didn't really affect me any. I wish I would have known sooner, but, you know, it's just a matter of mentally, you know, just adjusting myself to going from, fighting a grappler to fighting a striker.
The last time you were in Vegas, you fought Rashad Evans, and it was on TV, and it was a hell of a fight, and it certainly was the high of highs and the low of lows afterwards. How did that day and how that weekend change your life forever in terms of the way you fighting and just your personal life?
Even though I lost the fight, it was really almost like I won because I got so much positive attention because of the fight, not only from fans around the sport who may not have really known a lot about me, but also from the UFC, from Dana White. You know, they were all very impressed with how well I fought. you know, considering my short time in the sport. And, you know, that I guess, you know, that I had a lot of heart, I guess. Something's thrown around a lot, but, you know, I can take a punch and I don't, you know, give up easily. So, and then, you know, the next day, my mom passed away in Vegas. And that was, you know, totally made me forget about everything that had been going on, you know, cause, regardless of the fact that I lost the fight, you know, everybody was really upbeat, positive about what had happened, you know, that I'd fought so well. So, you know, after that, it was, my thoughts were totally off of that and just focused on my family and, you know, taking care of what we needed to, you know, after my mom's passing. But the UFC was awesome. They, you know, they went ahead and covered another night's stay for us, and they got us, you know, rides wherever we needed to go, and really bent over backwards to make sure this, you know, as hard a time as it was, they made it as easy on us as possible so that we could get everything we needed to do, take care of it, and get her back to Missouri and take care of all the funeral arrangements and everything. So, it was definitely a hard time, but, my family was really close, and they just brought us closer, so.
What does your family think of you being a full-time fighter now?
Oh, they love it. My mom was a huge fan of the sport. I mean, she didn't get introduced to it until I started fighting. I mean, I remember when the first person I told that I was going to start doing this was my sister. And I told her and she was like, you know, you must have lost your mind. People get killed doing that. I'm like, no one died doing what I do. You know, everybody has, that doesn't know anything about the sport has a skewed perception of it, but, you know, and I told my mom, I was like, well, you know, I'm doing this cage fight. She's like, what's that? I'm like, well, it's kind of like wrestling. And she's like, oh, you always like wrestling. Well, that'd be fun. And I told my dad, and he thought I'd really lost my mind. And then when my mom found out what it was, you know, I came home and I brought magazines and showed her some tapes of some fights and stuff. And she was pretty concerned, but, you know, my first fight was on national television. It was on HDNet. My first pro fight, she got to watch it. She had a big party over at a friend's house, and they watched the fight. She was always really supportive. She came out to my second pro fight that I had, which, lucky for her, it was just, I mean, the guy never threw a punch or a kick at me or anything. He just kind of curled up in a ball, and I beat the crap out of him. And then the fight after that was a major bloodbath against a guy named Mike Dexter that was also in the WC. I told her not to look on the internet at the pictures, but she did anyway, and she kind of freaked out. But, you know, she was always really supportive. And when I was on the TV show, she, you know, she told all the people she worked with, and I would go to visit her at work. She was a nurse, and all of her coworkers would want pictures of me and autographs and stuff. So she was really proud of what I did, and, just happy that I was happy doing what I did. So, you know, I've had great support from my family. I've been happy for that.
You talk about the reaction you've gotten from people in real life just after the fight. In terms of your everyday life, how have things changed in terms of your reaction from everyone that you've met in person, just on the street or walking around? I mean, how have things changed since being on TV?
Well, I mean, I've really tried to not let it change me at all. I don't know, a lot of people, I guess they would think that, you know, being on TV and stuff, and that you go everywhere and everybody knows who you are, and but it's not really like that. I get recognized every once in a while. People will come up and, you know, say that they, you know, it was a great fight you had. And that's very flattering, you know, the people come up and notice you for those things like that. I mean, the biggest change has had in my life is that, because of being on the show and being able to get sponsors and stuff, I don't have to work anymore. I can just train. I can train full time. That's really helped me, become a better fighter. And I live in Iowa, so it's easy to stay out of the spotlight when you live in Iowa. So it's, you know, the good thing about Iowa is there's not a whole lot of temptation, so I have a pretty easy time to keep my nose to the grindstone and stay working on my fight game instead of getting caught up in all the TV stuff.
Now, we mentioned that your opponent was changed, and it was switched to Dan Christensen, who was another heavyweight on The Ultimate Fighter. How much do you know about him going into this? Obviously, you're going to know a good bit. You've trained with the guy on the show, but, you know, obviously that was quite some time ago when it aired, and both you and him have probably advanced a lot. What do you know about his game now, and basically how prepared are you to fight him specifically?
One of my teammates, Ben Rothwell, fought Dan last March, I believe it was. And Dan beat Ben. Ben's a very good fighter, a good stand-up fighter. And so I've gotten some insight from him, as well as, you know, some guys that are on the show that trained with Dan. I didn't really get a chance to train with Dan very much. Just I think one day before we split up into teams, because we were on separate teams on the show. You know, and I've watched his fight with Seth, and, I mean, really most of what I know about him is just from watching tapes and talking to people. I know that he's a, you know, a good striker, and, in his ground game is also, you know, pretty decent. He has submitted some people, in his fights and knocked some people out. So, you know, I think he's a pretty well-rounded fighter, and he's a big guy. I think, you know, I think that I bring more athleticism and, you know, strength, than he does, but he certainly has the fight experience on me. So it'll be a good fight, and, I'm hoping to show how much I've learned since I got in the octagon the last time, and, show people that, you know, every time I step in the ring, I want people to see a different fighter, you know, and to see it better every time. So I think I'm going to show that this fight.
Assuming things go your way during this fight, what's your ultimate prediction? How do you want to end it? How long do you see the fight going?
Oh, I really don't like making predictions about things. This is a fight that could potentially go the distance because, you know, I think that he'll come in a great shape. He trains with a great team. Jackson Fight Team is a great team. You know, he's got a good chin and he can take some punishment and give it out. So, you know, it could go to the distance, you know, that way, or, you know, we both are heavy hitters, you know, so we can get knocked out. So, I don't want to make a prediction on anything. I just, I think that, you know, I'm ready for this fight. I think that it's going to go in my favor, but I don't want to say what round or how.
Excellent. Well, Brad, good luck on your fight, and we really thank you for taking the time out of your training schedule to talk with us, and we'll be seeing you at the Ultimate Fight Night.
All right, great, man. Thanks for the time.
Pride Fighting Championships has reached a milestone in its Bushido series. Bushido 10. Pride Fighting, in its quest to showcase the world's fastest lightweights and toughest welterweight fighters, is giving you Bushido 10.
Excellent, excellent.
If you want real fights with real athletes, then you found it. Pride Fighting Championships. Bushido 10.
ProgressiveDVDSource.com is your home for the latest and greatest in Progressive DVDs. Yes, they have it all there at ProgressiveDVDSource.com. Check out some of their most recent updates, including New Japan's 1-4-2006 Tokyo Dome Show, which is now available, including the main event of Shinsuke Nakamura versus Brock Lesnar. Dragon's Gate shows from December featuring the debuts of Jack Evans and Roderick Strong. Best of 2005 Volume 1, and now in production, Best of 2005 Volume 2, featuring Dave Prazak, Dr. Keith Lipinski, and Adam Summers. Yes, this and so, so much more. Check out ProgressiveDVDSource.com.
Are you a fight fan? Kakuto.com offers the best memorabilia from K1, Pride, Zero-One, New Japan Pro Wrestling, and so much more. Japanese goods, Japanese prices. That means you pay what a customer pays in Japan. You can't beat it. www.kakuto.com. That's www.kakuto.com.
We'll be right back.
back, everybody, to Fight Opinion Radio. Once again, I'm your host, Rob Sayers. Joining me during this segment is Zach Arnold. And Zach, I want to talk a little bit about the Bushido 10 show and some of the stirrups occurring from there.
Well, I'm looking at the show, and we were promised a new condo. And the media, they spent the whole week talking about how he was working on his new plan. He called it SAQ, his speed, agility, and quickness. And we were going to see a brand new condo, and he was going to become the anchor for the June welterweight tournament in Japan. They were going to do a Japanese-only tournament there, and he proceeds to get killed.
Well, it was definitely a new condo, and one that get knocked out, I think, faster than we've ever seen him knocked out. So it was new in a sense. You got to wonder what is going through the minds of these Japanese fighters when they decide to stand with Phil Baroni. You know, the man hits like a truck. If he hits you on the button, you're going to go down. And it wouldn't be so bad if his ground game wasn't so weak. You have these Japanese fighters who are classically great at submissions, and still they choose to stand. You know, what's going through their mind when they do this?
Maybe we should give Phil Baroni some credit here. Maybe he really does get under the skin of these guys as much as he gets under the skin of a lot of fans.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of guys are going in there to prove a point, saying they can stand with, you know, the New York badass, and they can beat him at his own game. But, you know, as we're seeing, the only time you beat Phil Baroni is when you take him down and keep him down.
And even then, it took Minowa a while to do it. What happened was the first fight they faced each other, Baroni got him, you know, by KO, and then they had a rematch, and Minowa went over on him and pretty much gassed him out and got the win. But it took him at least a round, if not more than a round, to do it.
Yeah, to get him down and keep him down. You know, Baroni's one of these guys. He every time you count him out, he comes back. He's got a mouth that people love to hate, but, you know, it's hard to dislike a guy who's been counted out, who's brought into an organization to feed to some of their, you know, some of their Japanese fighters, and then ends up doing pretty well for himself. And
Well, in many respects, he is the classic Japanese heel. And heel is a term used in wrestling as a bad guy. In Japan, they've always had a classic relationship with bringing in Americans as the bad guy, where they have the American go over or beat several Japanese fighters, and then they set up to a bigger match with the heel, eventually losing to the Japanese hero. And, you know, in this case, you got Baroni, who's got KO wins over Minowa, Kondo, and Shonan, and it took Minowa in the rematch, you know, some time to get him down on the ground before he got a submission or whatever, but I mean, Baroni at this point, he really saved his career. And if you're Dana White, you're wondering what happened.
Absolutely. I remember reading an interview with Baroni quite some time ago where he mentioned that as a friend, Dana White actually suggested that he retire. I mean, Dana pretty much told him he was over before he headed over to Japan. And being Dana White and the kind of fighters and the kind of fights that he's trying to market, I mean, you almost have to be kicking yourself right now seeing somebody like that over in Japan not, you know, not fighting on your cards. He's exciting. He talks the smack. He brings that pro wrestling aspect that they want. And he comes in to deliver the kind of fights that they want to promote right now. You know, the slugfest, the wars, the, you know, the big one-punch KO. He's exactly, I think, what the organization wants to market. And, you know, arguably with good reason, but they gave that up. And I'm sure that they're none too pleased with this.
Well, another aspect of this is Phil Baroni's getting paid. I mean, in Japan, they're paying him, you know, good money. I mean, and maybe not be great money, but they're certainly paying him a lot more than he would ever make in UFC.
Absolutely. And, you know, and it just adds to the story, I think, of the semi-washed up UFC star who came to Japan to lose and is now knocking everyone out and making better money than he ever made in America. So if you're Phil Baroni, I think things are good right now. I mean, hell, Phil Baroni, look at the whole Hammer House. This is just, I think, furthering the momentum started by Mark Coleman when he beat Shogun. You know, you almost want to expect a miracle win from Randleman next.
Well, Randleman certainly had his miracle win 2 years ago against Mirko, and then he ended up doing that suplex on Fedor and nearly killing the guy.
It's the, it's the classic Hammerhouse thing. They, when they're counted out the most, I think, is when those guys shine the best. So maybe as long as we keep doubting them, they'll keep doing well.
Certainly in the open weight tournament, you got to think Baroni, if he's interested in doing it. Randleman, Coleman, it's going to be very intriguing to see what happens.
You know, for a team that receives so much criticism for, maybe stamina, lack of technique, lack of ground defense, they seem to be on a roll right now. I forgot to mention, there was the Gracie versus Hammerhouse event not long ago. And, Team Hammerhouse ended up winning that. Despite everything that's happened, this is probably the best time in that camp's, lifetime.
Speaking of another guy who's on a roll, how about Joachim Hansen?
Yet another. I mean, is the man capable of winning and not being described as brutal KO? It hurts to watch him win fights. Whether it be by knee or kick, when people go down, he does it with authority.
He has a list of victims that runs a mile wide, that's for sure. And if it wasn't for him kicking Mr. Calagiri in the nuts, he would have the Shooto belt as we speak.
Yes, absolutely.
I got to say, between Baroni and Hansen, Pride does have their two respective Gaijin heels in the weight classes. Now the question is, can they find the Japanese aces to take over those weight classes at this point? Because if you're Hansen, you're thinking, what do I fit now, given that Marcus Aurelio has beaten Gomi? That has certainly screwed everything up for him.
That fight definitely threw a wrench in the rankings. I'm not sure where Aurelio was really ranked before this fight, but beating not only the guy who is number one in the division, but considered by many to be number one pound for pound in any organization, that definitely throws a wrench into things. And if you're Hansen, you absolutely have to be wondering, where are you right now? This was a good solid win against a really tough guy from Shootbox. It's obviously going to do nothing but good for his stock. It was a good fight. He fought from beginning to end. So, it wasn't a freak KO or anything like that. I think he pretty much dominated most of the fight, especially early on. So his stock rises, but where does it put him exactly now that the rankings are all screwed up?
He always seems to be in limbo.
I agree. He's one of these guys who just seems like he's capable of being somewhere he actually never gets.
He is a man, if Dana White wanted to spend the money, he is the man to bring in, but Dana White's not going to pay him five figures.
I agree, because it's another, the Pride fans know him. Shooto fans obviously know him, but, who in America knows who this guy is? He's not American. He's Norwegian, right?
That's right.
Yeah, I think foreign fighters are a little harder to market to the American audience. I don't think it really would be worth the money for UFC to spend on him. Obviously,
well, what is the KO rate of Hansen in fights lately? I mean, it's pretty strong. If you're Dana White, you want a guy like Hansen who could really bring it.
I agree, and we have the lightweight division back in the UFC. You would think they'd be trying to fill that talent pool, and maybe a guy like Hansen is who they'd be courting. I don't know that the UFC feels it can market a guy like that, but his fighting style, like we'd mentioned about Baroni, a guy who will sit there, slug it out, puts on an exciting fight every time, and when he wins, it's generally by brutal KO, which is what everybody likes to see. Looking down the results, we have a few, we have a couple guys who really needed wins and ended up getting them. One was our guest from a week or two ago, Mr. Eves Edwards, who, was talking on the show about how he needed to get back into a winning streak. And it looks like he kicked that off, scoring a judge's decision against, Ikemoto.
He faced a guy with a 500 record and, it was a good fight for him to take, certainly for the money, that's for sure.
As far as getting back into winning, it was probably a good, maybe a tune-up fight, not being thrown into thrown in the cage with a top lightweight, you know, and hopefully this just builds momentum for him and he can kind of get back on track.
It's going to be interesting to see what happens in his career, because what would UFC do with him, and where is he going to fight in America at this point?
Being the former uncrowned king of the lightweights in the UFC, you know, I think that he's going to be back, and I think we're going to see a rematch with him and Hominick. I think that's one you could market pretty well. You know, one could argue that was almost a fluke loss if you wanted, and, you know, I think a lot of people want to see a rematch there. You know, maybe some of the newer fans don't know who he is. The people who have gotten into sports since The Ultimate Fighter don't know a lot about the former lightweights of the division, because, you know, the division was gone before The Ultimate Fighter. But, you know, your older fans who do know and do remember a lot of the older fights, you know, they're going to want to see a rematch here. It was sort of the same thing, I think, with Gomi and Aurelio. You had a guy who nobody gave a chance, and he ended up, you know, beating the guy who was considered to be the top in that division's, in that organization's lightweight division. So, you know, I think that he definitely has a place in the UFC again, and winning over in Japan is only going to help that.
Absolutely, and I'll say this about the IFL. If the IFL is listening, they need to sign that guy now and put him up against Jens Pulver.
No lie.
You know, Jens Pulver winning on that, on the Bushido card, once again, facing a last-minute replacement opponent, Masakazu Imanari, had an asthma attack, and he went to the hospital, so they replaced him with pancreas veteran Kenji Arai, and that didn't stop Pulver.
For the longest time, and I even read an interview, him saying that he didn't really care about winning as much, he didn't really feel any pressure to win in a lot of his fights. He wanted to put on a good show, and for a while there, it seemed like he forgot he was an MMA guy and was just trying to box. But I think it's fairly evident by his soccer kick win here that he's decided to get back on track, actually winning fights. And, you know, with a guy like Pulver, I think an exciting fight is just, you know, it's a side effect of him winning no matter what, or him even fighting. He always brings a lot to the table, and it's good to see him bring back a win. He's a real likable guy, and you know, he did really well in the UFC early on, and he's just one of those fighters you just like to watch and, you know, love to see win.
Absolutely, and if the IFL's smart, they'll market that 155 division, because believe me, that is a division where you can get a lot of international talent. If they want to spend the money to do it, they'll do it.
Absolutely. You know, the lightweight, I think, is probably internationally the most competitive division, because, you know, you have the Brazilians who don't necessarily have the best record in some of the heavier weight classes. You have the Japanese who definitely are in that case. Once you get past, you know, welterweight or so, they're sort of out-muscled and outsized by the some of the fighters from other countries. But in lightweight, you have great fighters from every corner of the world, and I think there's so many competitive fights you can set up, and I think that division is just waiting for somebody to market it properly. We're going to see, opposite of boxing, I think in mixed martial arts, we're going to see that become kind of the preferred division, along with some of the other lighter divisions.
I agree on that, and if the IFL wants to live up to its name, which says international in it, they'll definitely have an international flair to it. Speaking of the IFL, they signed a brand new TV deal last week. The announcement came with them releasing a press release about their deal with Fox Sports Net. They're going to have two shows in May, and they'll have a show in June. The May shows will be split into two parts, and they'll have each team. They have four teams. They'll have the teams face off in two separate shows, and the winning teams from those two shows will go on to the June show.
Now, what is your opinion on this? Is this going to be good for the IFL, and is Fox Sports really the right outlet for the IFL?
I think the IFL, given that they're in the largest media market in America, which is New York, the backers are anyway, I think it would have been smarter if they had made themselves some sort of identity first before deciding to go national. And I know that's going to sound crazy, but why not identify themselves as a regional powerhouse? They're in the largest media market on the planet. And yet Fox Sports Net has very small reach in New York at this point. I mean, it is trailing behind other networks. The YES Network, which carries the Yankees. MSG Network. The brand new Sportsnet New York Network, which is the network ran by the Mets. I mean, realistically, Fox Sportsnet in Chicago and New York and these other cities is not a big deal anymore. And if they want to become a national player, they're proclaiming themselves to be national before they even ran a show, you got to get something better than what they've done. I mean, it's so predictable. I mean, UFC went on Fox Sportsnet. Pride went on Fox Sportsnet. Mixed results so far, but, you know, the NFL's got to show me a lot more in terms of business savvy than what they've done so far.
I agree, and this is, again, the NFL continues to leave us kind of scratching our heads, and I think a lot of questions will be answered once they finally do air their first shows. And going back to Bushido a little bit, DSE has decided to do things a little differently, and instead of just airing a tape-delayed pay-per-view, they are actually airing three of their fights on Fox Sportsnet, free TV, and then they're going to air the additional seven fights on U.S. pay-per-view. Now, what's your take on this move, and how do you think this is going to affect kind of their exposure here in the U.S. market?
I think it's a terrible move, but I'll tell you why. One, what kind of message are you sending to your pay-per-view customers that you're going to air your three biggest fights from that show on free TV? And that the pay-per-view customers for $30 the day after WrestleMania is going to get seven matches that you didn't deem to be good enough for free TV. And second, Pride's strategy of airing these three matches on the current show flies against the whole strategy they've had the entire time in the U.S. market, where every show on Fox Sports Net's been the same format where you show old matches and old highlights, and there's no current build up to pay-per-views or the current events that they're doing. It's just a haphazard strategy that they've got going here. Look, don't get me wrong. I like seeing MMA on free TV as much as anyone else, but there never seems to be direction with that company, at least in the U.S.
I agree. I think DSC has had there was some mismanagement in how they're handling their marketing in America. You know, as far as showing three of the fights on free TV, I think it's a fantastic idea, but leaving them out of the pay-per-view is probably one of the worst things they could do. You know, if the best fights being aired on free TV, who's going to bother buying the pay-per-view? If, you know, I'm going to spend $35, I want to see the whole event.
I'll frame it this way. Let's say that Pride had in the past done this. If there was a history of them doing this, at least you could understand the history of them trying to build up the free TV show. But they've done nothing with the free TV show. And you know, they pay for that time. I mean, essentially, they're buying time.
Yes.
And I've never seen them have a certain direction of what they're doing with that show.
Well, I'll tell you, one of the early shows they had was actually the Rampage Liddell fight, which I think was sort of some anti-UFC strategy, personally.
Oh, I mean, the first show was Jay Glazer basically, sitting behind a silk screen background and just talking about how all the big boys from UFC wanted to come to the Pride ring, and was like, the first show was basically just a slap in the face against UFC, but instead it just came across as small.
And speaking of more management, the UFC has been hiring some big names. We have, of course, as mentioned previously, we have Mark Ratner from the Nevada State Athletic Commission, John Mulkey, who's a Wall Street gaming analyst. Everyone has said all along UFC's problem is not paying their fighters, and it seems like their answer to this is now hiring more big names and paying these guys instead of the fighters. What's your take on this?
Well, it's a smart move from a business perspective, but in an industry where fighters don't have very good representation in terms of agents or managers, this is another step forward into really making UFC similar to what WWE has at this point, which is you have 300 or 400 employees sitting at Titan Towers in Stamford, Connecticut, in New York, in the New York area. And you have wrestlers who work, you know, maybe $750 a week, maybe $1,000 a week. A lot of young workers who actually lose money working for the company. You're having a similar situation here where you've got fighters working for UFC where they're getting paid $2,000, $3,000, maybe $4,000, at least the undercard guys, and they're not making enough money to train all day. I mean, Jason Von Flew, in a recent newspaper article, talks about how he works as a bartender.
Absolutely. And that's real common. You have a lot of fighters who are still, working their day jobs. Jorge Rivera, I believe, still works as a construction guy. It's real common for some of the undercard guys who work as bouncers. Some of them are instructors at the gyms where they train. And, and it's just a situation. It seems like they're taking care of everything but their fighters now. And I understand that, our market's different. They can't be paid like they can in Japan because, the cultural differences and this and that. But you can still pay them a lot more than you are. You could pay them double and you still wouldn't be close to what a lot of these guys are making in Japan. So, I don't know. I just think their priorities are in completely the wrong place. And it kind of goes back to, an off-sided criticism of the UFC is the fact that they tend to market the brand instead of the fighters. And this is another step where they believe their brand is more important than the people fighting for them.
Well, that very well may be true in terms of the brand selling rather than the fighters. But at some point, the difference between UFC and MMA and pro wrestling is that in MMA, it is a global business. There is money at stake. There are alternatives. There's cage reach in the UK. You have groups all over the place. Canada is becoming an option. Japan's an option. It's no longer an isolated industry when you're talking MMA. So there are options for guys to make better money. So the trap UFC runs into is, do we actually have the talent to claim that we have the best fighters in the world? And that goes to the heart of credibility of what they sell on TV. Because if the fans don't think they have the best fighters in the world, they're not going to buy into the brand.
Well, while that's true, if people want to watch MMA, I really don't think they have many alternatives. You have Pride, who wears pay-per-views, but, we were discussing previously how they're kind of fumbling the American market. Maybe the UFC has room to mess these things up, and maybe they know this, and maybe they realize that, while fighters have other places to go, do fans really have other places to go for, their MMA exposure? Aside from, the stuff that Pride is airing on Fox Sportsnet, what MMA do you have on free TV right now? Just yesterday, I sat around all day watching Ultimate Fighter reruns. I don't think that the UFC is really concerned because they realize, they're the only alternative as far as the big exposure here in America.
They don't have to be concerned now, but in 5 years they might have to be.
I agree. And, I hope for their sake they're not being short-sighted about this, and maybe they have a better plan than either of us are predicting. And that's going to do it for this week's edition of Fight Opinion Radio. Be sure to tune in next week. We're going to be discussing the UFC 59 card and kind of talking about who we think the winners and losers are going to be there. And we'll also be joined with special guest Jake Roston. For my co-host Zach Arnold and Aaron Bucknell, I'm Rob Sayers. Thank you, and tune in next week.